LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. We've all heard of NIMBYs, people who say no to growth in their backyards. Well, now there's a counter-movement, and it just held its first conference.
This was the first gathering of folks that identify as YIMBYs, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. The movement recognizes that in our high-cost cities, the cost of housing has gotten out of hand.
Hear from Scott Epstein and others in a moment. Before we get to that, though, 100 years ago, African-American Civil War veterans proposed a national monument to their civic contributions. That idea evolved into the museum that finally opens this weekend. It's called the Smithsonian National Museum of African-American History and Culture, and it sits on 5 acres on the National Mall, just yards from the Washington Monument. The building stands out. While many of the mall's monuments and museums are white or grey and built in a neoclassical style, this new museum is bronze-like in colour and covered in a lattice of intricate metal patterns. The long-awaited project was designed by the team of Freelon Ajay Bond Smith Group. Its lead designer was David Ajay. He has been quoted as saying he wanted to build a dark, brooding, bronze-like building, but it's a darkness in an interplay with light. Ajay recently spoke to NPR's Ari Shapiro.
I kind of wanted the building to sort of give you the feeling of a kind of a hot summer with sunlight dappling through the trees. That in a way, the building is almost analogous to a giant tree with an incredible shade. And also, I wanted it to be a museum where when you came in, you weren't suddenly in an interior that was about focusing on marble and stone and classical forms or whatever it is, but to come in and to have light be your guide.
We'll hear more from the designers in a moment. The museum has a collection of over 17,000 artefacts, each telling a story about the African-American experience. Michelle Norris is former host of NPR's All Things Considered, and she explored some of those stories in an article for National Geographic magazine. And those stories start with the architecture itself.
It is a building that is big and bold and stunning in its architecture, and juxtaposed with all of the other buildings that are there on the National Mall, which are stoic but somewhat staid in their architecture. This building is as if there are a bunch of people sitting at a Wall Street meeting, all wearing their blue and gray suits, and Beyonce walks in with sequins from head to toe. I mean, boom, the building just stands out. It makes such a strong architectural statement that attention, you know, must be paid every time you go by it. And it was so, I think it was such a bold choice for them, not just because of the architecture, but because of the way that this building is commanding this country's attention to a history that it has struggled with over time. And it has been a difficult history for Americans to lean into, and Lonnie Bunch, the founding director, and his team of designers and curators and architects decided not to tiptoe into the space, but to walk into the space very boldly.
And dressed very boldly, because I think one of the points you're making with your description of this building being the Beyoncé in this room of dreary old staid suits is that it is sort of analogous to the time period when African Americans dressed boldly to convey a message at a time when they were being so oppressed.
Well, I think it's how African Americans over time have dealt with oppression through their art, through the way that they adorn themselves, through their language. You know, as I note in the piece, with, you know, bling and church hats and zoot suits and things that may seem outsized, but they are expressions of culture, but they are also very strong expressions of confidence, even at the moment where the culture was trying to diminish people of color.
And so this museum, which holds thousands of artifacts, straddles those that really speak the story of utter degradation and those that speak the story of extraordinary creativity and confidence in the face of that degradation. Can you single out some of the objects in that story?
There are a few things that you know, when you visit someplace and then the image still lives with you,
mm-hmm.
you still remember how you felt. The shackles that are just so teeny because they were meant to be worn by a child. And it's not the first time I've seen slave shackles, but they're just so small and so delicate. And when you think about, you know, think about your own wrist or your own ankle. I mean, that's one of the most fragile parts of our bodies, no matter how large you are. It's pretty small. And so a child is teeny. You know, it's just arresting to think that bondage began that early. And when you see the shackles, you also see the artistry in the they're oddly beautiful. So you think about the person who made that, knowing what it was going to be used, you know, how it was going to be used. And one of the things that the curator said is that when they put the exhibits together, they wanted people to think about history from lots of different viewpoints. And so when you look at a shackle like that, you think not just of the child who has to wear that shackle, but also of the person who made the shackle and then the person who had to place that shackle on a child's wrist or ankle, and their place in history too. It's really brilliant how they ask the audience to consider history from lots of different viewpoints and to look at it from lots of different sides. It is a museum that makes you think.
Mm-hmm.
You are asked to do a little bit of work when you go through this museum, and you are the better for it. And it's not just, you know, all pain and struggle. I mean, there are also moments of, you know, of triumph. George Clinton and Parliament and the Funkadelic's mothership is in the museum, and you see it there, you know, in all of its glory and the story behind how they found it and how they had to get it out of his house and how it was sitting in his living room and they had to cut out part of the ceiling because he literally had the mothership, you know, of the Parliament and Funkadelic, the mothership was sitting in George Clinton's living room.
Now, it sounds as if the process of assembling the items on display has in itself been a very interesting story and brought forth a lot in people's lives who've contributed artifacts. You open your article with a very interesting story about a woman who donated a medal to the museum. Can you just tell that story?
Well, I don't know of many museums who put out sort of an all call for artifacts. From the very beginning, the founding director, Lonnie Bunch, wanted to fill the museum with items that tell the story of African Americans in America. And he thought that many of those items were not in museum collections or not being housed by collectors, but were sitting in people's attics and basements and trunks. The woman who opens up the article that I wrote for National Geographic, her name is Gina McVeigh. She lives in Sacramento. She called the Smithsonian because she wanted to donate artifacts that she had found in her own family, artifacts that she found quite by accident. She always knew that her grandfather, Leslie McVeigh, had served in World War I, but she did not know that he had this storied history, that he was part of a regiment known as the Harlem Hellfighters. She went to visit her mother in Los Angeles and discovered in what they called a chiffre robe, a large chest of drawers in her mother's home, all of these artifacts that basically spelled out his life, that he had received the Croix de Guerre, which was the highest medal that you can receive in the French military, that he was part of a regiment of black soldiers from the U.S. that was basically loaned to the French because they were not allowed to fight under the U.S. flag, and they had fought with valor and had returned to this country as heroes, and then somehow had kind of drifted into obscurity. He died literally in obscurity. He was found on a park bench in New York, and he had been beaten. And he, you know, left this earth without ever sharing this story with his family members. America has had some really difficult, really painful chapters, starting in slavery, moving through segregation, and evidenced by the nightly news, you know, where we're still trying to figure a lot of this stuff out. And sometimes it's easier not to talk about it, not to dwell on it, not to even hold it up and sort of look closely at it. And this museum seems that it's trying hard to provide ways for people to lean into something that they might otherwise avoid.
That was Michelle Norris, former NPR host and founding director of the Race Card Project. The realization of this museum was an internecine process. That's according to Philip Kennicott. He's architectural critic for the Washington Post, and he's followed the building's construction. While there's much about the design he admires, he does say he's sorry that cost-cutting meant a change in the materials on the facade, from bronze to bronze-coated aluminum. Nevertheless, we asked him, did he agree with Michelle Norris's assessment of the museum as being akin to Beyoncé in a sparkly dress walking into a room of dreary suits?
I love that description. Everything about it except for maybe the sparkly part of the dress. Certainly this building is very, very different, and it has an energy that is strikingly different from everything around it. This building is along the north side of the mall on Constitution Avenue, and Constitution Avenue is where all of the main Smithsonian museums that people love to go to, and in most cases they're quite traditional classical architecture. The National Museum of African American History and Culture, because it has this corona on it, has this kind of upward thrusting energy, as if it's if you had your arms up in a kind of V shape and then produce that in kind of three tiers. So yes, it really does have that energy. And I do see the idea of this being quite different than the kind of button-down suit idea of some of the buildings near it. The only thing that's really to be regretted is that that dress doesn't really sparkle. Now, that might seem like a small thing, but what I've argued, unfortunately, in my review of the building is that the corona is so essential to the building that that was the one thing they really needed to get right. Unfortunately, the cost of the building went up and up, and they had to make compromises. And so the big compromise really was to the sparkle of the dress.
You've also written about the interior experience. What is the physical space on the inside like?
The interior of this building is very much unlike any other Smithsonian museum in Washington. It begins quite traditionally. You enter into a large glass atrium. But to begin the exhibitions, you actually take the elevators down and you go very deep underground into what turns out to be a cavernous space that reaches almost up to the ground level. And the exhibitions are put into little side galleries inside this kind of canyon-like space. It's very, very dramatic. It's not filled with natural light, so it's lit in a dramatic way. Once you've gone through the history galleries, you have some choices. You can kind of decompress in what they're calling the Oculus Room, which is sort of a meditation space. And the thought is that the power of African American history and the pain of African American history will make a lot of people want to decompress and think and pause for a moment before they go upstairs. Because it's on the top layers of the museum, on the third and fourth floors especially, that the exhibitions that are devoted mainly to culture, the more celebratory exhibitions that show the resilience of African American culture. And the tone of these two different spaces is quite different.
In terms of the configuration of the building, something that's been commented on is this important sight line that's been set up and what that might signify. Can you talk about that?
So the museum looks directly onto the Washington Monument. And the proximity, of course, is heavily symbolic. This is the monument to the founder of the country. And this was a monument to a man who had slaves, to a group of men, the founders, who many of whom kept slaves. And so that proximity is very, very loaded. There's also a sense that because you create these strategic cuts through the corona of the building to look at the Washington Monument and some of the other major buildings in Washington, that these are, in a sense, observation posts or even keeping tabs on in a way, that there's a sense of a reverse surveillance of the city of Washington coming out of this building. This building doesn't just sit in Washington. It looks out onto it. It studies it. It's related to it by these incredibly dramatic sight lines.
Now, last time, Philip, that you and I talked, it was about the efforts to get Frank Gehry's Eisenhower Memorial through what you've described as this internecine process in Washington. As we know, that memorial has met many roadblocks. Now, with the realization of the Adjaye design, do you think Washington might be more open to more inventive architecture?
I think it has certainly set a precedent for doing a kind of architecture that has never existed on the Mall before. This is absolutely unlike any other building there, just simply because of the materials it uses and because of the transparency at the base of the building. So absolutely, it's going to be cited as a precedent for doing a different kind of architecture going forward in the future. And to that, I say, great. That is a major accomplishment.
That was Philip Kennicott, architecture critic for The Washington Post. So what about the architecture team itself? Well, lead designer David Adjaye spoke to the BBC World News earlier this year about how he thinks the building will be received.
I mean, I think some people will love it and some people will find it difficult. I think it's a building that's not background. It's really something that makes a statement about where America is right now. And then I think in the world that we live in, where issues about how our cities are made up of different diversities and different groups from different ethnic groups, this project goes straight to that sort of discussion, because it talks about the nature of America and how its communities are brought together. And it talks about a very important community who were used for commerce to make America, who feel that they've been sidelined and who now have a place on the Mall rightfully.
David Adjaye is not entirely new to DC. He has already designed two small libraries in the district, but his career really took off in the UK. Adjaye was born in Tanzania to Ghanaian parents. His father's a diplomat, but he studied in London and found his first clients among that city's art world. Lucas Dietrich is an editorial director of design books for the publisher Thames and Hudson, and he's published several monographs about Adjaye's work, as well as a 7-volume collection of Adjaye's photographs of African metropolitan architecture.
He was very clever at using inexpensive materials in a very opulent way, like chipboard, for example, or floor decking or terrace decking used as a wall covering. Because of his nature, because of his intelligence, the fact that he was doing fairly high-profile projects at a young age also got him, made him very media-friendly. So he got sort of picked up by the art worlds, the style and fashion worlds, and that just gives you much greater reach as an architect, who are often working sometimes almost in a monastic way, or building buildings for their peers rather than building buildings for people who are actually going to make them more familiar to a wider group of people.
Lucas, I think it's fair to say that there's extremely few black architects. In America, for example, I think about 2% of licensed architects are African-American. So do you think that was ever a factor in people's interest in him?
Yes, and I think he would also acknowledge this. I mean, I think I would prefer to say African, but he's comfortable, I think, with both descriptions. You know, he is the only well-known black architect in the world, which I think is a great shame. But he, I think, has done something very special. But it isn't just, it obviously has very little to do with his skin color, but it makes him stand out. But he also acts as a kind of medium, I think, for people to understand what tendencies in African design might be, which I think I'm right in saying do play a rather important role in the new Smithsonian Museum.
That was Lucas Dietrich, editorial director of design books for publisher Thames and Hudson. David Adjaye's partner in the architectural team was Phil Freelon. He's a leading African-American architect who's based in Durham, North Carolina. He had teamed up with the late Max Bond, who's a patriarch of the African-American architecture world, and together the pair worked with the Smithsonian on the pre-design and master planning for the museum. Then in 2008, the design competition for the actual building was announced, and Freelon and Bond got a call from Adjaye, by then already a superstar in the architecture world. They met at a coffee shop in New York.
This was late 2008, early 2009. We met and we liked David. Obviously, he's a great guy, but you never know. With architects, some have the reputation of being difficult or ego-driven or whatever. And so we were curious to know about David. We knew about his work. We admired his practice. You know, Max and I and David got along very well, and then we all agreed that David would be added to the team, which was then called Freelon Adjaye Bond.
Max Bond passed away at the end of the competition phase, just before they submitted their design. The competition included more than 60 teams, among them highly regarded names like Norman Foster, I.M. Pei, Dilla Scofidio and Renfro, Moishe Safdie and others. but what Freelan Ajay Bond proposed was an engagement between Western architecture and the architecture of African heritage.
After all, at the end of the day, this is an African-American museum, so there's a component that is African and American and African-American. So that is one part of it. The porch that you see there is an expression of American architecture, particularly in the South, this welcoming gesture of creating a transition from the landscape into the building and, you know, merging those two. So there's the corona, there's the porch, there's the pattern of the corona, which has African-American roots in that concept of how the pattern was derived, linking it back to traditional ironwork in places like Charleston, Savannah, and New Orleans, where the guild work of enslaved Africans and freed African-Americans can be seen even today in these ornate patterns of the ironwork.
D.C. is famous for its Byzantine process of getting any kind of architecture with a difference up. You know, it's quite restrictive in terms of sticking to neoclassical architecture. How did you manage to cut through that?
Through many, many meetings and, quite frankly, through the open-minded approach that the commissioners, like on the Commission of Fine Arts and the National Capital Planning Commission, you know, came to the process willing to listen and to be engaged in a way that brought understanding to what we were trying to do. And also, you know, listening from our end as well. There were suggestions and notions about how things might be adjusted that we took to heart and responded to.
What was your feeling on seeing it when, you know, people started to go in and it really has become other people's building? Do you have a sense of yourself, Anne David, and the late Max Bond being part of African-American cultural history in America? I mean, it must be a pretty powerful feeling for you.
It is. It's a feeling of pride, humility, and also appreciation for having the opportunity to be involved. And that history is noted in an exhibit in the building, you know, in a prominent location right outside of the Oprah Winfrey Theater. In the lobby, there is a display that chronicles the design going back 100 years when the idea first was broached by African-American Civil War veterans, you know, and so on through history. And it talks about Freelan Ajay Bond and the Smith Group and, you know, that collaboration. There are photographs, there's a model. So, yes, it's part of history and it's commemorated by the very museum that we designed.
That was architect Phil Freelon, part of the team of Freelon Ajay Bond, who, with Smith Group, designed the new museum. Coming up after this break, battles over gentrification and growth have stopped housing projects in many high-cost cities. But now there's a movement forming of people who say the only way out of this mess is to keep building.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton.
Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country, you've heard of it, it's called NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y.
Not in my backyard.
That's the late George Carlin mocking NIMBYism. That acronym entered popular culture in the early 1980s, though some argue it went back to the 1950s. It is the pejorative term for people opposing pretty much any kind of development that is too close for comfort, from landfill sites and prisons to preschools and affordable housing to high-rise housing for the rich. But now anti-development forces are producing a backlash and a counterforce is growing. And they held their first conference in Boulder, Colorado in June of this year. Scott Epstein is chair of the Mid-City West Community Council, and he attended that conference.
This was the first gathering of folks that identify as YIMBYs, which stands for Yes in My Backyard, sort of activists and policy leaders across the nation that are trying to create a movement that builds inclusive cities that have room for all kinds of people in our neighborhoods and across our cities.
Does inclusive mean building stuff?
It does. You know, the movement recognizes that in our high-cost cities, the cost of housing has gotten out of hand. And you can't fully address that without building new housing that's both market rate and affordable.
And what happened at this conference?
So it was a very interesting conference. It was structured as an unconference, which means that we led it. It wasn't sort of like we came and got lectured to, but it was a way to share ideas across cities and how we sort of address these issues. So different folks brought different topics around how do we build coalitions, you know, how do you address ballot measures that may not be helpful to increasing housing supply in cities, and lots of other topics.
The impetus for this YIMBY conference was victory on behalf of Boulder's pro-growthers, who defeated a slow-growth initiative there. Similar initiatives to restrict development are appearing on ballots in other high-cost cities, including here in Santa Monica and in Los Angeles.
I mean, I think we do need to defeat these measures. I mean, that's sort of a first step for Los Angeles, because what we really need to do is get together as a city and as a region and come up with a constructive approach to increasing housing supply. I think there are a lot of great ideas about how to make that work that will increase the livability of Los Angeles. But we need to have that conversation.
So you're saying this really is a national issue?
It is. I mean, I think it's concentrated in high-cost places. So a lot of the people that were at the conference were from places like Seattle, San Francisco and the Bay Area, New York, places that have very similar problems in terms of the cost of housing. But I think it is a national issue.
Did anyone pose the idea that perhaps it's time for people to just pick up and move to Detroit, you know, move to St. Louis, sort of lower cost cities?
I have heard that perspective from people through my community work. I did not hear that perspective at the YIMBY conference, not surprisingly. We believe strongly that it's an economic and moral imperative that we should build places that have room for people. You know, that we want to be neighborly. And that includes not just people that are already living in places, but people that desire to live in places.
Is there an element of sort of intergenerational conflict here?
To some extent. You know, I think the YIMBY movement is coming out of, I think, a lot of the leaders are young people who are realizing that our current housing and transportation policies are getting in the way of the economic welfare of themselves and of all people in these high-cost cities. And many of the people that are opponents of new housing are people that have lived a longer time in these neighborhoods and are older. So there is that element to some degree, but I think that there are advocates on both sides of all ages. And I think more and more people are understanding, even homeowners that have owned their homes for a long time, they're realizing, well, hey, wait a minute, where are my kids going to live? You know, I want my kids to have just as good a lifestyle and economic well-being as I do, and they can't afford to live in the neighborhood I live, or maybe even afford to rent in the neighborhood that I live. And so I think more people are waking up to the fact that we need to have this conversation. We need to come up with some solutions.
That's Scott Epstein, attendee at the recent YIMBY conference. He's also Community Engagement Director for the New Urbanism Film Festival. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. So who are the leaders of this growing YIMBY movement? One is Oakland's Sonia Trauss. The New York Times reported that this lady uses guerrilla tactics that, quote, others are too polite to try, like hiring a lawyer to go around suing suburbs for not building enough and trying to elect a pro-development candidate to the Sierra Club's executive committee. She does all this with a group she founded 2 years ago called the San Francisco Bay Area Renters Federation, also known as SFBARF.
And I founded it because a couple years ago, I live in Oakland, and it just seemed really obvious that San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay, had a lot more people than housing units. And there are a lot of people that want to build housing, but, you know, it gets blocked up at the local government level, at the planning commission or at the neighborhood level. And I just knew that there were people out there that were pro-building and wanted to see more housing built, but that just we weren't organized. So I started organizing people that agreed with me.
And you've been attending planning meetings. You've been sort of carrying the banner for building. And this has kind of, I think, caused ripples in San Francisco.
Yeah, it was very novel for people to show up and say, I live in some other neighborhood, but I'm a renter, and this is a renter's issue. And in the long term, you know, we're hurt when we can't build enough. So build this. And, you know, it would only be like two or three of us, right? Not a ton of people. But there were usually only ever maybe two or three or maybe 10 opponents. You know what I mean? So on both sides, we're not really talking about huge crowds.
You're saying that relatively few people would actually show up to oppose a project, and then you would come in and kind of surprise people because you didn't have a vested interest directly in the project that was being built, and you would come in and say, please build this thing.
Yeah. There have been a couple regional polls that are showing that renters and young people are much more pro-building than homeowners. But absolutely, renters and young people are the people least likely, you know, to show up at a neighborhood meeting or a community meeting or a planning commission meeting or anything like that. So for better or for worse, a small number of people really can give the impression to elected officials and commissioners that there's many more like them out there.
Now, have you had any successes in terms of seeing a project get built that looked as if it was going to be stopped?
I did have one time. This was in a town like just south of San Francisco. I had the mayor tell me that he was just counting to see how many speakers there were for and against. And we had brought more speakers in favor. And so he voted yes on the project. And I think that should be encouraging for pro-growth people that it really is worth it to show up bodily. I mean, it was like, you know, 7-4 and 5 against or something like that. Not a large number of people at all.
Now, one of the arguments that I'm sure you've heard from the slow growth side is, why support the interests of developers who are generally hoping to build market rate or even luxury housing that many of you renters that want to see these buildings built aren't going to be able to afford anyway?
Because if we don't build expensive stuff for high-income people, the high-income people move into existing housing. So it's not, and this is a very confusing thing. I definitely have had a lot of people say, but you're never going to live there. Why do you care if it's built? Well, I live in West Oakland, which is the first BART stop as soon as you leave San Francisco, right? So everybody who works in San Francisco downtown who can't afford to live in the Mission, you know, or some other neighborhood very close to San Francisco, where do they start looking? They start looking in West Oakland.
So the other question is, you know, a lot of these slow growth movements in San Francisco, in parts of LA, other parts of the country, are motivated by a desire to maintain something called character. The idea that these groups don't want to see a now rather lovely neighborhood that has a certain scale, a certain style of architecture. They don't want to see it disrupted. How do you reassure those folks?
We don't. I mean, politics arises out of conflict. At some point, you just say, I have different values and priorities than you. I'm going to organize the people that agree with me. You organize the people that agree with you. And we're going to have to see what happens at the ballot box. Basically, I'm going up against people for whom having a home and a secure home isn't enough, but they're not happy unless they prevent other people from having homes too. And I don't think that you can convince somebody whose worldview admits that kind of hostility.
Sonia, were you involved with planning and politics before you started SF BARF?
I worked for my neighborhood association when I lived in Philadelphia. I volunteered there and then worked there. At the neighborhood level, I was kind of involved with neighborhood politics when one person wanted to put up a deck and their neighbor was concerned, you know, I don't know. But really not in a big way at all. I mean, every day I'm still learning so much new stuff. The instinct that I had that turned out to be right is basically, though, that success in politics is very straightforward. It's just about gathering your people, you know, finding people that agree with you, put everybody on the same mailing list, and then try to get people to come out. I used to like throw parties a little bit, right, in college. I find it to be sort of similar because it's like you have a series of events coming up and you just have to make sure the people that you think would be interested know about it and help make it easy for them to come out. But that's all there is really to politics.
That's all there is except the alcohol.
No, there's so much alcohol in politics.
I love the party analogy, but I think some people are going to be find it hard to be persuaded that showing up at a city council meeting is somehow equivalent to going to a party. Can you find a way to persuade people that a city council meeting can be fun?
I mean, if you think that type of stuff is fun, it is very fun. I have to say, the last few months especially, I think that we've really hit critical mass. You know, a group of people that actively enjoy each other and really do enjoy the process. It is a social world, you know, being involved in politics. So sometimes people say it's hard to make friends in their 30s. I don't know what they're talking about. I've made millions of friends. So, you know, it's socializing with a purpose. I think people should try it out if they haven't tried it before.
That's Sonia Trauss. And as you heard, she's pretty much in favour of any development. Now, that view is not shared by all YIMBYs. Back to Scott Epstein.
Certainly, YIMBYs don't support every proposed housing project. I think we generally want to create livable communities, and some projects don't do that. Some projects tear down rent-stabilized housing for people in neighbourhoods and replace them with luxury townhouses. Some projects have too big of a footprint and don't really fit into the neighborhood. So there are reasons to oppose projects, but I think generally we think there are a lot of ways to add density that are well within the character of neighborhoods.
Scott Epstein's view is echoed by Carl Hansen. He's Director of Government Affairs for the Santa Monica Chamber of Commerce. But it turns out he is not a full-fledged YIMBY. He gives himself a slightly different acronym.
I consider myself, I guess, a MIMBY. So,
maybe.
Yeah,
maybe,
yeah, maybe in my backyard. I want to see a project. I want to know about it. I want a city council member to do that. I definitely don't want to say yes to everything, but I definitely think we have to say yes to some things. And with many projects, I'm definitely YIMBY. And I think that's a good attitude to have. I think NIMBYism is incredibly dangerous because it's just pushing responsibility outside of your own court. And the consequences of that are really serious.
That's Carl Hansen. Now, do you consider yourself a YIMBY, a MIMBY, or a NIMBY? Let us know by commenting on our Facebook page. Just search for KCRW DNA. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening.